You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 1189.PS7902, certificate number 35821. Summerton Man.
And this is where he met his end.
Right here. And to take your secrets with you.
And take your secrets with you.
Summerton Man, Summerton Man.
Summerton Man hates. That's a rare slurp between the number and the... And mm-hmm. the name of the show. Here, let's do it again. 35821. Summerton Man.
Delicious coffee.
It's good.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't know.
I'm drinking my soda quietly and no one has to hear it.
Yeah, your Diet Dr. Pepper.
Politely.
Have you even had a decaf coffee? You never have. Is the prohibition, it's not on caffeine because that Diet Dr. Pepper is full of caffeine. So it's on coffee specifically.
Yes.
The Devil's Brew.
Coffee and tea. The devil's twin brews. The devil in the Western Hemisphere fools us into drinking coffee. Mm-hmm. In the Eastern Hemisphere, fools us into drinking tea.
Coffee and tea and the Java and me and the devil and me.
See? I don't know what that is.
Cup, a cup.
What is that? Jazz?
It's jazz.
Is it an ad for Folgers?
That's another thing they don't let you do in Salt Lake is listen to jazz. Cool jazz.
No, you get to root for the Jazz.
Oh, that's right. What am I talking about? You stole a whole basketball team.
It's a real jazz center. Salt Lake loves jazz so much that they named a basketball team for it.
That they bought the company.
When you think of like America's amazing history of black music, don't you think of Salt Lake City first?
At least Oklahoma had the decency to rename their basketball team and not call it the Sonics.
Yeah, Sonics could have worked for them, sure. I guess.
As much as jazz works for Salt Lake, what were they even thinking? They should have named it the Beehives.
I feel like today they would have, because then it's just a chance to kind of brand your city. You don't want to borrow New Orleans' old weird ABA branding.
Yeah.
But at the time it was like, no, you keep the name.
You have to keep the...
L.A. Dodgers.
L.A. Dodgers. Fast break Fodgers.
Is that also a jazz standard? I don't know.
That's a little bit of a jazz reference, yeah.
Are you scatting about the Dodgers?
Yeah, there's a couple of people on LSD right now who are getting everything I'm saying. Stop listening to the show on acid. It's bad for you. What would you name the Salt Lake basketball team if you had to do over?
There's a women's team there, right? The Grizzlies or something? Or is that the... For a while, it was double Z everything. No, the Grizzlies is the hockey team. It's the Stars. I think that's there.
Yeah, but that's no good.
That's a little
Would you call it the Frontiers?
The
Pioneers.
The Seagulls, the Pioneers. What's the Spiral Jetties?
No, but like I think.
How about the Spikes, like the Golden Spike?
What were the, the Spikes. I like that.
Sounds more like a volleyball or a football team.
Though. Was there a special name for the Pioneers? Did they have their own?
Like Steve? A lot of them were named Steve.
Come on. None of them were named Steve.
They were all named Hezekiah. And stuff.
Steve was a 1970s name. Yeah, Hezekiah and Ezekiel and Nosferatu. Yehoshaphat.
A lot of Z's and K's.
Yeah. Well, I know you like a mystery.
Mm. My eyes lit up in mid-slurp.
I know they did. And you like a murder mystery.
Is this a murder mystery?
Do you?
Does it have an old lady? Is it a cozy mystery? Is there knitting?
I mean, I guess, yes, a little bit. There's some haberdashery.
Is the detective kind of a hard-drinking single man, or yes, is it a 100%. Or is it a kindly village widow, gossipy widow?
There's a lot of there are some cops involved, and they all seem to be. They're not exactly bumbling. They're on the case.
Is this copaganda then?
No, the cops don't solve the mystery.
Okay.
What percentage of the episodic television that you and your lovely wife Mindy watch involves a murder?
Probably less than most people.
Uh-huh.
We're not quite old enough to watch procedurals yet.
Do you like comedies?
I think we mostly watch whatever the peak prestige TV thing of the week is.
And but you don't think that involves murder?
Sometimes it kicks off with a murder,
yeah.
Right? But usually now it's an anti-hero. We're like following the murderer. It's not like which of these people is the murderer. I guess I've watched a few Which of These People is the Murderer show lately.
I feel like
the after party's pretty good.
So much contemporary media involves a murder that it's possible you wouldn't even think like, oh no, well that show's about just a bunch of British couples on a vacation. But it's like, yeah, but the murder that starts it all up. Brings me to that is I went last night to a
murder mystery party.
Well, basically, I went to my seventh graders' arts night where groups of kids at this junior high wrote and produced and acted in their own plays. There were seven plays.
Oh my gosh, no wonder there was a murder.
I had to sit and endure seven plays written and produced by seventh graders, which was itself like a little bit of like seven soul murders.
How many of them did you murder in revenge?
I murdered no kids because I'm getting to know them and I see ways in which they may benefit society someday. Right now it's clear that none of them do, but one day seventh graders will become.
Someday theater kids are going to rule the world.
Ooh, please. That's the ugliest curse I've heard.
Nobody else can finish a sentence, you know? It's going to be a one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind scenario.
But of the seven plays, I think four of them were murder mysteries.
Ooh.
And three of them were, wait a minute. It might even be more. One of them was a wedding, like a love potion number 9 type situation. But no,
problematic.
Maybe there were six of them that were murders. I don't know. But a lot of murders.
In the building.
And it feels very much like, if you're a team of seventh graders writing a play.
That's a pretty big if.
Yeah. Okay. If I'm a team of seventh graders writing a play. If you were a bunch of seventh graders in one giant overcoat trying to get into an R-rated movie.
I would certainly write a play first.
But I do feel like murder, kind of like zombies, are the lazy tropes of our time, right? You know that you can get people engaged.
It immediately gets. I mean, many even non-mystery, lots of great works in other genres will begin with a murder because
there are stakes. Instantly, there are stakes,
and instantly the audience is like, "Well, I've got to stick with this. Which of these people? It's not just that I need to know who did this. Which of these people that walks among us is a killer?"
Well, and that's the thing. As I was watching these seven plays and noting that five of them, or maybe six, started with and hinged upon a murder, I thought to myself, how many murders have influenced my life? How many situations have I been in where what I had to do next was something to do with a murder? And I can say none. I have never had a murder play any major role in what I do, I've never been asked by the cops about a murder.
What if you go broadly? Like, what if, let's say the Kennedy assassination.
Okay.
Changes LBJ's Vietnam policy.
Okay.
And therefore, maybe your parents are, you know, living in a different city, or I guess that probably wouldn't have happened.
No, but they were already pretty fully ensconced by LBJ's tenure. Because, older parents.
So even the Kennedy assassination did not affect your life?
Not really. Because, you know, if my dad had gotten a job in the Kennedy administration, like I think he probably should have if he hadn't done something terrible and screwed it up.
Oh, is that a murder?
It wasn't a murder, though.
Did your dad kill Marilyn Monroe and make it look like suicide, John?
It was definitely some form of career suicide, but that might have changed our path, but no.
I don't think I even know anyone who's had their life touched by murder, or at least in a way such that it's enough of their story that I know it. Like, well, you know, of course, after my mom was killed, I can't even think of one of those.
There are a few people I know who, you know, have had a major accidental death that affected their life.
Sure, but I can think of those.
But anyway, thinking about like how much television, how many films I've watched, how many seventh grade plays I've watched that involved murder.
Murder's overrepresented.
But none of us, I mean, I'm sure people listening are like, well, actually, my uncle was murdered.
Yes, sorry.
Apologize.
It should make them feel even more special to have us talk about how unusual murder is.
Apologies to the uncountable number of futurelings who are like, actually, murder is really common in my Indiana town.
And apologies to murderers.
Hmm. You know what? It never occurred to me, but there is, I know for a fact, just statistically, at least one murderer, unprosecuted murderer listening to the show.
Do you really think so?
Yeah, who is totally titillated right now, like,
I don't think
they're talking about me, they're talking about me?
I don't think that's true.
No, it's for sure true.
No, what percentage of Americans do you think are uncaught murderers? Let's say 30,000 people hear this show. You think one in 30,000 Americans has gotten away with murder?
I think our listenership is closer to 50,000. Just based on my own rough...
Just based on vibes.
Just on vibes. let's see. How many uncaught... This is where Google would have once given me an interesting reply. And all I had to say was how many uncaught... And I misspelled how. How many uncaught... And then Google fills in serial killers are there. So let's see. In the U.S. alone... FBI estimates they're 25 to 50, so probably not.
Well, those are serial killers. Most homicides are not a serial killer. It's going to be just guns.
How many uncaught killers?
You shouldn't be looking for killers. You should be looking for how many unsolved homicides there were.
Oh, and then it says, do you want to see results closer to you?
For murderers?
That's Google. Screw you!
Hey, Google, do you want to know about the murderer standing right behind you?
So you're right. It keeps coming up with serial killers, and that's not... I don't want to give away this topic too soon, but what we're...
Yeah, heaven forbid.
What we're talking about in today's episode is an event that figures prominently in the pop culture of Australia and New Zealand, so much so.
Are you telling me Australia has culture?
Well,
I mean, ish.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they put shrimps on Barbies, as you know. They have big knives. This is all an American would know.
I'm just envisioning a Mad Max movie, and it seems like they don't have time for a lot of theater because they're, you know, always, you know, dragging chains behind their muscle cars.
Just give us the oil. Leave the oil. We will set you free.
Are you telling me the Mad Max movies are not a documentary about Australia?
There's In Excess, right? Which we know from their hit record Shabu Shaba. Okay. There's AC/DC. Hello.
That's culture.
Hello.
Hey, okay, there were 20,000 murders. You know, murder is up. You know, it was once as low as maybe 14,000 a year. But even let's say now it's 20,000 a year.
20,000?
Police clear about half of those, leaving about 10,000 unsolved murders.
10,000 unsolved murders.
Let's say the average, let's say each of those murderers is unique. 10,000 uncaught murderers.
There you go.
In the U.S. every year.
You have to assume some portion of those are mafia hitmen and other gangsters who are in the business of murder.
That means, what? One in every... 30,000 Americans is a killer. Now we're talking. There is one murderer listening to this.
Statistically. But what I'm saying is uncaught murderers tend to be the smarter of murderers.
And like podcasts.
That's what I'm saying. If you're a smart murderer who's uncaught, chances are you're more likely to be listening to Omnibus than, say, some uncaught murderer podcast.
It's the dumb guys on death row that are like, hey, can I listen to the new Dax Shepard before? And they're like, no.
No.
Your last meal cannot be a Dax Shepard podcast.
Sorry, buddy. But Omnibus listeners are sitting in their parked cars giggling about their unsolved crimes.
I got away with it again, and now Ken and John are talking about it.
Yes. So if you are a murderer, send us an anonymous communication, which I know murderers are good at.
Yeah, cut out the letters in the little note. Maybe make a word search like puzzle for us to solve.
To 55744 Shoreline, Washington 98155, and include some information about an unsolved murder that only you could know.
That's right. Maybe tell us, if we crack the code, maybe we can find your next victim.
There it is.
We'd be into that.
There it is. Give us some advance notice so we can solve the crime, and then our listenership will explode.
Will it?
As people are like, how? Ken and John solving murders.
I guess we need to make sure that our murderer listener does not kill any of our other listeners.
Okay.
We don't want to lose victim listeners to our one murderer listener.
But Dax Shepard listeners, if the word gets out, don't listen to Dax Shepard, but switch to Omnibus. There you'll be safe from murder.
Why are we targeting Dax? I'm sure Dax is lovely. Why did he become our...
He swears on his podcast, not like us.
He swears?
Yeah,
he says swears on his show?
There's swears, yeah. Oh
my gosh, does Kristen Bell know about this?
I think.
You think she knows he says swears sometimes?
I think it's probs. Thinks probs.
She's like, you guys have your poker night. I'm going out. Don't say any swears.
Don't say swears. And then he's like, tee hee hee. And he interviews somebody, I don't care who, Christian Bale. And they say swears together. No, but I feel like that could be a tagline. Like listen to Omnibus, be safe from murder.
You think actually listening to the show makes you safer?
If we agree with the killers not to kill people who listen to Omnibus.
It just means the dumb killers who get caught are going to kill our listeners.
Look, I can't make any promises about dumb killers.
I can't fix the whole world. You know?
Dumb like, Kevins are out there everywhere.
Kevin does seem like a good murderer name.
It's a great murderer name, except he needs a middle name because all serial killers have murder names. Kevin Seal McDonald Pants.
Seal? Why is his middle name Seal?
Well, because he used to host MTV's afternoon show. Did you ever meet Kevin Seal?
I've never met any VJs.
He lurks around Seattle. He used to be involved.
Oh, he's the one that lived. Yeah, I know. Okay.
He used to do alternative theater here, and I was in a couple of plays with him. He's great, by the way.
I mean, I knew his...
His lay wife.
His lay wife a little bit.
Yeah.
I totally forgot Kevin Seal was the one who lived here.
They were both great, but they couldn't make their marriage work, and now...
Is that the... That's the...
That's, I guess.
That's what you learned?
That's my takeaway.
I'm not sure any of these random things are connected.
But this story in Australia and New Zealand will be so familiar to them that they are probably both jumping for joy because we're actually mentioning Australia. And even though you teased them earlier about not having culture, at least we're talking about them. And as you know, just based on vibes, we have a lot of listeners in Australia.
Do you think they're like Canadians in that they just like to be talked about, even though they know it might be a mild teasing?
Well, I mean, Canadians, A, love to be teased because they're cucks, and B, everything anybody in America says about Canadians is a tease by default. Americans never praise Canada without also teasing. So it is kind of a Stockholm syndrome with them where they're like, we hate America, but love it.
We should praise Australia, though. I mean,
but Australians are more, you know, they're rough and tumble. They're more like, oh, they don't care. They think it's all funny.
They're good, friendly guys. Like their national ethos is like just being a good guy.
Hey, I'm a good guy.
I'm your mate.
They all kind of have hair on their backs. You know, they're like, rawr. And so I think they like to be talked about for sure. And I mean, and the ladies too.
The Sheilas?
Down there, the Sheilas. Woo! When dingoes aren't eating their babies, they're listening to podcasts.
See, that's exactly the kind of thing Australians don't want to hear on a podcast about Australia.
They don't like that whole dingo story.
Well, of course.
It makes them mad.
To us, it was a Meryl Streep movie, not to them.
No.
To them, it's like the OJ trial and the Dred Scott decision all in one.
Yeah, dingoes are coming in from every direction, and it's like, but we've talked about Australia a lot on this show. We've done several episodes about kangaroo fences and shipwrecks that involved murder. Wait a minute. Or murder.
Well, I mean, it's a country founded by murderers.
Thank you. You said it, so I didn't have to.
You were saying that maybe this is a story that's even too familiar to Austrians. Like, this is their, what, their D.B. Cooper? This is their Jack the Ripper? What is this there?
So D.B. Cooper is a great example. Do you think that D.B. Cooper is widely known throughout the United States, or is it mostly, because here in the Pacific Northwest, we have D.B. Cooper all over everything.
I have a stuffed D.B. Cooper. I slept with a stuffed D.B. Cooper as a baby.
We went to the Highline History Museum over here in Burien. That is mostly like, in Burien, we used to have a school was built by pioneers.
I parked there illegally once to go to the cookie place.
There you go. It's right by the cookie place. There's a big exhibit of like, there once was a trolley. but there's a little alcove off of the room that's like, Boeing! They used to build airplanes not very far from here, and those airplanes used to be really well built and not... The company wasn't shitty like it is now. There's an alcove devoted just to D.B. Cooper, who, of course, boarded the plane right here at the SeaTac airport. And the room is painted black. The walls are black.
Like this is something we have to be serious about?
Yeah.
Like this is like Burien's Vietnam Museum?
Yeah, and I took my daughter there, and she was like, I don't want to go in there. It's scary.
The ghost and of like, D.B. Cooper might be
Listen,
there.
Listen, I'll hold your hand, and we can go in and learn about D.B. Cooper. And she said, I know all about D.B. Cooper. I just don't want to go into this dimly lit room. And even, I mean, as far as the Highline History Museum goes, D.B. Cooper is like that's the scariest thing that ever happened around here.
I think it's national, especially now in an age where everybody knows, like, what used to be a weird little nook of history, people now only know the same 60 weird little nooks of American history.
Right. But they don't even care about Bigfoot or the Bermuda Triangle anymore.
Did you know that you just said, like, shitty a second ago? Like
I said a swear?
Like you're Dax Shepard or something?
Oh, no.
You're like, it's like I'm doing a show with Dax Shepard up in here.
I try so hard not to say swears.
Famously foul-mouthed Dax Shepard.
You know what it is? I'm one of those swearers that when I'm around swearers, I swear, and when I'm not around swearers, I don't swear.
To feel cool.
Well, are you swearing? I'm not swearing. And no, it's just I'm very suggestible. I don't have any own values.
What about my presence made you think it was okay to say that, I can't remember what you said was shitty. What did you say?
No, you're swearing.
What did you say was shitty? I can't remember.
Now it's rubbing off on you. What was it?
The
Highline. Oh, no, it was the Boeing. It was Boeing Company. Oh, well.
Okay, well, that's correct.
You know, I don't retract that.
We stand by that.
We stand by that.
Because Boeing would never sue us for saying their planes fall apart.
We have supported Boeing with our blood, sweat, and tears in this region, and they, because of corporate malfeasance, have besmirched their once stellar reputation.
They've run out to South Carolina where you can make planes with bad door plugs for cheaper.
I don't even blame the South Carolinians. I blame their corporate masters. Late-stage capitalism. Harumph, harumph.
You're not wrong. Wait, don't they still make the bad planes in Renton? Didn't they make the Maxes in Renton, or
did
they not?
Here's what they do. They assemble them in Renton out of parts that were made in Italy and Slobovistan, and they're all made with metric measurements, but that aren't even metric. They're Slobovistanian metrics.
You can see why it's complicated.
And then they bring it back here, and it's like, this doesn't fit. Well, we'll just put it in there with spackle, all to save a dollar.
Just a dollar.
Just a dollar. Like, and an Australian dollar at that.
Is that more or less?
60 cents on the dollar.
Really?
How much is an Australian dollar worth right now?
No idea.
You know what? This show really would like to thank our corporate sponsors, Google, for listening in and also being available to tell us what the Australian dollar...
It is about 66 cents.
66 cents. Like, see, I follow the trades.
One U.S. dollar is $1.50 Aussie.
Yeah.
I have a friend who just moved there. He like got citizenship.
Australia?
Loves it.
How did they give him citizenship? What did he bring to the
equation? Apparently, it's not that hard. You just have to live there a while and swear fealty and say you're a good mate.
Fealty to whom?
The queen? Oh, it's not clear.
Is that still true?
The king?
I don't know. I mean, I've never been, so I can't really disparage, but I know a girl, or I guess you would say now young woman.
A Sheila,
who appeared to be an heiress of some kind, but then got a job at a zoo.
What?
And then became like an animal rescue zoologist type person. And she sends me pictures all the time of wombats and sugar monkeys and blue-footed boobies.
Is she in Australia?
Yeah, she's an Australian Sheila.
She's sending you photos of her boobies?
Well, no, her blue-footed ones, yeah. And I'm like, listen, I mean, if you're going to send me secret pictures DM style, why not?
No wallabies, please.
Yeah, why not you in a sweatshirt with nothing else? And she's like, no, here's a picture of a sugar monkey. Or a kangaroo that's got a thorn in its paw. I'm like,
I'd rather have
those. It's pretty nice, actually. It's pretty fun.
Yeah, why don't you tell her to send me the cute animal photos and leave you out of the equation? Well, this sounds great.
Yeah, it's great because she's got inside scoop. But this is what I'm saying about Australians, right? What are the chances? She reaches out across the ocean and she's like, would you like me to send you pics? And I'm like, sure.
Of my sugar monkey.
Yeah. And then she's like, here's a bat that got caught in a net that I'm rehabilitating.
Here's a sad emu.
Yeah, right. Or you know what? It's wombats that are the craziest things. They're so cute. They're big. And I thought it was just a joke animal. Like, oh, wombat, sure.
You thought it was like a made up, like an urban legend?
Kind of. Like the platypus aren't real. But apparently a wombat's not only real, but it doesn't resemble a bat or a womb at all. It's a whole separate thing that's like a giant guinea pig dog
thing. Fantastic.
Yeah.
We've all learned so much today.
I've got a whole folder full of pictures of them wearing casts and stuff. Anyway, yes, this is a very well-known story in Australia. Because it's, you know, like you were suggesting, maybe the only interesting thing that's happened in the country in the last 80 years.
They had that prime minister die swimming and then they named a swimming pool after him.
Oh, I never heard that. No, there was the swell fella that got killed by a stingray that everybody, he should have been president.
We love that guy, speaking of Australian zoos.
We do. He's nice.
He's fine.
Anyway, he's no more. But that has nothing to do with what we're talking about. What we're talking about is an event that happened on December 1st, 1948.
Oh, wow.
A long time ago. And this is still a big part of Australian. I mean, when I lump Australia and New Zealand together, I think New Zealanders are sometimes like, that doesn't have anything to do with us. Why are you? We're all the way over here.
Just because it must be how Canada feels.
Yeah, right. Like, oh, North America. Canada's asterisk. Like, not really. We put gravy on our French fries.
I mean, there's Anzacs.
Well, there are, right. And when I'm talking about World War I, I'm going to lump them together. But when I talk about, like, urban legends I don't even know if New Zealanders put shrimp on Barbies. They probably don't. They probably do something completely else with shrimp.
Do they even eat shrimp?
They must. They're an island nation.
They're just little hobbits, though.
Aw.
Are they just eating...
They're so cute.
Aren't they just eating mushrooms?
Anyway, I'm just going to confine this story to Australia because I don't think New Zealand has anything to do with it. No, you know what it is? They probably get Australian television. So they know about this.
It is Canada.
Yes. I bet. They're not making their own sitcoms there.
Does New Zealand have its own sitcoms? I would Google this, except I'm just going to get crazy results about how the... There was a New Zealand exchange student on Saved by the Bell once. When I lived in Singapore, Singapore had one of its own sitcoms. It had just started, and it was a huge deal. Like, everyone was very patriotic that Singapore finally had a sitcom.
I bet you New Zealand has a sitcom.
Well, they have Flight of the Conchords. That's like...
That was an American sitcom.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
In December of 1948, on the beach in Adelaide, Australia.
Adelaide is south, right?
Yes.
Okay. I can picture this.
A body was discovered on the beach, laying, a male person, laying with his head against the bulkhead.
There's a bulkhead on the beach?
Well, it's a city beach. It's in Somerton Park.
Wouldn't that be a wall, not a bulkhead?
Well, what's the difference between a wall and a bulkhead?
A bulkhead is a wall, but you're on a boat or a plane? I don't know.
No, a bulkhead is, yes, you can, a bulkhead is on a boat, but also a bulkhead is a wall that keeps the
like a retaining wall on whatever those are called.
Yeah.
Like a seawall or something?
It's a seawall. It keeps the ocean from eroding the
city of Adelaide.
The city of Adelaide. That's exactly right. It's gonna wash Adelaide away. And as you, I mean, Adelaide is not just in the south. It's like around the hump. It's in the dimple,
right?
It's in the blight or the bite.
It's not a blight.
It's in the Great Australian Bight. It's in the bay.
I'm picturing Australia as kind of having two buttocks. Is that right?
Yeah, this is up in the taint.
Queensland comes down and makes one buttock.
Melbourne is as far down as you can go.
And then there is kind of a little crotch up there.
A little bite, which is, and I mean B-I-G-H-T, and Adelaide's up in there. And so this body is discovered. He's in the sand. He's right across the street from, and this, you know, and I, trigger alert that this has a
corpse,
a word we wouldn't use anymore. He's on the beach right across from the crippled children's home.
Which used to be the nice way to say disabled children's home.
His head's on the seawall. His feet are crossed. He's nicely dressed. He looks like he died when sleeping.
So it's not like a washed ashore situation?
No, not wet.
He's not wet.
On the right collar of his coat is an unlit cigarette.
Sitting on the collar?
Yes.
It seems like it's kind of precariously balanced.
That's right. Might be a sign of something. Might be a clue.
Like a hobo code.
In his pocket, he has an unused train ticket to Henley Beach.
Is that nearby?
Near enough.
Okay.
For the purposes of our story, but not nearby. It's a train journey.
Bet he wish he'd used that ticket. He might still be alive today, but probably not because that was 75 years ago.
A long time ago. He would not be alive today. He's estimated to be about 45 years old.
He'd be 115 today.
He has also a bus ticket from the city of Adelaide in his pocket that is possibly also unused.
Possibly unused.
He has an aluminum comb, which was made in the United States. He has a pack of cigarettes.
Of a different brand than the one on his collar?
The packet is of the Army Club brand of cigarettes, which is an English brand of cigarettes.
Okay.
But inside are seven cigarettes of a different brand, Kensitas, which are Scottish.
This guy was maybe murdered for his weird habits. Like, he annoyed all his friends with his cigarette trading and whatnot, his ticket non-using.
He had a half a pack of Juicy Fruit gum.
Really? Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of impressed that Juicy Fruit existed in 1948. Mm-hmm. Did Australia invent it?
No. No, I think Juicy Fruit is one of those. It's like Fanta. It's one of the old.
Juicy Fruit, 1893, one of the original Wrigley flavors.
That's right.
It's as old as Wrigley Spearmint.
It's the only gum that wasn't licorice for the first 50 years of gum.
Boy, I bet Juicy Fruit fought to keep their presence here out of the headlines.
Well, here's the thing. Our man was in good physical condition.
Okay.
One might say prime physical condition. His nails were trim and clean.
Australians are very attractive.
He's a handsome.
My Australian friend sent me a clip of Australian Jeopardy, which was briefly on the air there. And just to kind of make fun of the host, because he's kind of a good time. You know, he probably hosted the top 10 countdown in Australia. He's not really fit to the mm-hmm. gravitas of Jeopardy. Mm-hmm. But the first thing I noticed is all three Humble of the brag. Contestants, they're all blokes, and they're all incredibly handsome. Like, each more chiseled than the next. And I'm like, wow, like, where do we get these guys on our show?
They're all swimming from a young age. You know, they run down to the beach and they fight kangaroos. I mean, they're hardy, hailing, welcoming.
Extremely hail.
People. They're very
extremely hail and above average in hardiness.
That's right. I mean, I'm sure there are Australian listeners right now who are like, I'm a podcast listener and I never go out in the sun.
No. Even Australian nerds are hotter than our nerds.
I'm going to destroy the earth with my plutonium reactor.
Why do they talk like that? He doesn't even have an Australian accent.
That's how nerds talk around the world. It's a separate race of people. Anyway, he is in what are described as American tailored clothes, but all of the labels have been removed from all the garments.
It's a real man of mystery.
He's not wearing...
Even if he hadn't died, he's very mysterious.
That's right. If he just came into your boarding house, you'd be like, what's going on with this
The
guy?
Murder is the least interesting thing about this guy.
Why does he have a cigarette on his collar? What is this about? He's not wearing a hat.
Which a little 1948 unusual in would have been weird.
But he has no wallet.
What's the cause of death? You haven't said, right?
I haven't said.
Okay.
And he is... he's noted to have the feet... and calves of a dancer.
Police work was a little different in 48,
mm-hmm,
huh?
Mm-hmm.
Like, who is the guy on the force who's in charge of deciding whether or not the deceased has the physique of a dancer, and if so, what kind of dancer?
So, you know, the feet are pointed in the sense that the big toe and the little toe are kind of headed together as though he wore pointy shoes, like dancer's shoes.
Couldn't he be like an elf?
Could be an elf, actually we'll see some elven qualities to him in a minute.
But it looks like he may have worn ballet slippers or something.
And because his calves are very developed, it is suggested that he spent time on point.
That's some Sherlock Holmes stuff.
Yeah.
Like somebody who sees a guy with like nice quads and glutes and pointed toes and is like, Watson, this man is a dancer.
Say it in an Australian accent.
It doesn't sound smart if you say an Australian accent. Watson.
Boy, it's a bit of a dancer. He's a dancer.
Dancer.
So, yeah, there's quite a bit. That's what I'm saying. These are not dumb police. These are Baltimore police. These are smart police. And they're putting this all together. Who is this man? These are the physical characteristics that stand out to us. And the coroner then does an autopsy. And determines that although he is sort of, you know, he has what in the parlance of the time, he has congestion of the intestines and, he's a 50-year-old man who okay. smokes Scottish cigarettes. His heart is a normal size. And his last meal was a pasty.
Okay.
Keeping in keeping with residents of Adelaide or visitors to Adelaide. And his spleen is three times normal size.
Wait, what?
He has a splenetic disposition.
He's not does this mean he's an alien? What makes your spleen three times the normal size?
Oh, you get, what does the spleen do?
Immune system stuff.
Yeah, right. So he's in good health, but he's got a large spleen. And the coroner determines that he did not die of natural causes. There must have been. He didn't die of a heart attack. He didn't die of a large spleen. It must have been poison.
But toxicology can't.
Toxicology at the time does not discover any evidence of poison. He hasn't thrown up. He's not. He doesn't show any.
But you can do tests for common poisons then. You can look at his tissues and see if he's been arsenicked or cyanided or whatever.
That's right.
I've read my Agatha Christie.
So it is neither arsenic nor cyanide. The suggestion of the coroner at the time is it's either a barbiturate overdose, but he would have probably vomited in most cases, or digitalis.
Ah.
But cannot be proved. They put out a bulletin about the death, and people come forward and say that they had seen him there on the beach the night before, And one strolling couple says that they saw him at 7 o'clock p.m. and he moved his arm.
Oh, he was lying on the beach, chilling.
Lying on the beach, I guess, fully clothed, with his head against the seawall.
Except for the hat.
No hat, and moved his arm.
A little weird to sit that long on the beach.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, unless you're dying or dead.
They call him Somerton Man? Is that the name of the beach or something?
Yeah, so Somerton Park is the neighborhood where he died. A decade later, some people came forward and said that night they'd seen a well-dressed man carrying another man on his shoulders through Somerton Park. But no, this was 10 years later, and no one else had that story to tell at the time.
When this comes out 10 years later, aren't you always a little suspicious?
Yeah.
It's like, this was probably pretty big news in the area when it happened, and back then you didn't say, oh, yeah, I have information.
Anytime someone comes forward 10 years after a thing and says, yeah, I have a report that damns this individual or many others.
Because this happens very often in unsolved crimes. 40 years later, somebody will be like, my dad told me he worked with the Zodiac.
It even happened to me recently.
Really?
Yeah.
What did you confess to?
No, as part of the Bean Dad thing.
Oh. Somebody,
you know, was like, oh, 9 years ago. 10 years ago. He was mean to me. But anyway.
But he didn't frame you for a crime.
Being mean is a crime on the internet. No, it was not.
Sorry. He wasn't mean to you. He said you were mean.
He
to
said
him.
I was mean.
I got it.
And,
got
or you. Rude.
But it was made up.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it was 10 years ago.
So maybe that guy did work with the Zodiac.
I think for sure made up, but, you know.
I would say.
No one ever.
I would say my dad cleaned floors with the Zodiac is a little less likely than John was mean to me once on the internet.
I mean, I was mean to you multiple times just
today.
In the last 2 days. Yeah, right. I mean, no one would doubt that I was mean, but.
No, you're actually very courteous in person.
Oh, that's sweet of you to say. So no one can quite figure out what's going on. And 2 weeks later, no, I'm sorry. This happened on December 1st, 1948. January 14th, so this would have been a month and a half later, at the Adelaide train station in the luggage checking room is discovered a brown suitcase, which had been checked in on November 30th, the night before the murder.
Left luggage,
which when investigated contained a dressing gown, a thing that no luggage would contain these days.
This thing has more clues than any fictional crime, much less any real one.
It has a pair of red felt slippers. It has four pairs of underwear, some pajamas.
Pajamas, they might say.
Pajamas. A pair of pants that has sand in the cuffs. So you can see the detectives are doing a wonderful job cataloging all the clues.
You're doing a wonderful job cataloging their catalog.
Oh, thank you. In addition,
do you celebrate their whole catalog?
I do. In addition, he has in the suitcase, which is now, I'll show you how it's tied to him directly. There's an electrician's screwdriver.
I don't know what that is.
Well, it's a screwdriver that's used exclusively by electricians in Australia.
They have their own weird screwed heads?
I mean, apparently. I don't know what an electrician screwdriver is, but it is identified as such.
This is an electrician's screwdriver, Watson. Our victim is clearly in the electrician's union.
That's right. That's what that would suggest. There's a table knife that has been cut down so that it is like a prison knife,
ooh,
like a pointy knife that was once just a tableware, a butter knife.
This is the first kind of vaguely criminal accessory this guy's
There's
had.
Very sharp scissors. And there is a stenciling brush, which is used almost exclusively in particular by third class officers in the Merchant Marines to stencil marine stuff.
Go on.
Think about that for a second. And there's a spool of Barbour orange thread, which was used to repair a rip in the pocket of the man discovered on the beach.
Oh, it matched the
rare orange Barbour thread that fixed his pants.
This almost seems comically choreographed.
Yes.
Hmm.
There are no labels on any of the clothes in the suitcase, but there are monograms on the tie on the T-shirt and on a laundry bag. Not monograms, but stitched names.
Of the manufacturer or of the owner?
Of the owner.
Oh.
It was not uncommon at the time to put your name on things with little stitches. The tie says T, initial T, Keane, K-E-A-N-E. The T-shirt says Keane, K-E-A-N. And the laundry bag says Keane, K-E-A-N.
So Keane is spelled multiple ways on his own.
On his own things.
Stuff.
So they put out an APB across Australia for a T Keane that is missing. Nothing comes back. Now this is an Australia-wide mystery.
They're asking, I would say a manhunt, except they have the man.
They're asking everybody, do you know anybody 45 years old who's missing?
Who has orange pockets.
Who would be in Adelaide on this particular day, well-dressed and in good shape with a train ticket, an unused train ticket.
Did you say the labels are cut out of his clothes?
Cut out. No labels in the clothes.
I mean, like that's not done as a matter of casual practice, right?
No, although it is a plot point in the Peter Sellers movie.
I don't even know.
You don't?
Let's see.
The Peter Sellers movie where he plays a kind of...
a being there.
A being there, right. One of the reasons they can't tell whether or not he's the inheritor of the estate is that his clothes are all custom made, but no labels. That was like part of the plot.
But I mean, you could have custom made with no labels because they're so too fancy to have labels. But in this case, he's wearing stuff that should have labels, but the labels have been removed to conceal possibly his origins. Or because they're itchy.
Isn't it nice? Could also be itchy.
Isn't it nice how underpants don't have labels anymore?
That's right.
They print the thing right on the waistband.
I personally don't like it. But yeah, I agree. It's not itchy. But I kind of liked the itch. It's a reminder of your mortality.
Really?
Yeah. But I tried.
Right up by my Adelaide, I like to have a little chafing.
I try not to tear out the labels of clothes that identify the brand or the size, but I do cut out the ones that are like...
Instructions?
Yeah, just like washing instructions.
That's like, you can't tell me what to do.
Yeah, screw you. I'm going to put everything in the washing machine. I'm going to hang it all dry. And Bob's your uncle.
Well, your murder will not be mysterious then, because we'll have all your brands.
Oh, good point.
It'll be like this guy clearly thrifted a lot.
I like a little bit of mystery.
Maybe you should start cutting out your tags.
So there is some indication, right, that if you were to have bought these clothes secondhand, it might be conceivable that you would.
Oh,
because
so,
they're
so maybe he didn't cut them out. It could have just been somewhere in the life of the.
Not clear. A lot of these clothes look to be American, but the coroner sort of identifies T. Keane as looking British, and in fact it says on the autopsy report that he's a Britisher type.
Britisher.
A Britisher type.
What do they say? A pommy? A palm? Isn't that what they say for British people?
Yeah. So several weeks go by, or months rather, and no one steps forward. They've made a plaster death mask in order to try and help their solution or help their case in finding because obviously they can't keep pulling his body out to show people, but they make this bust.
Even in Australia, you can't just keep pulling out a body.
No, that's right. And in 1948, probably, the coroner's office was refrigerated, but probably not the lobby. But at some point, several months later, a detective is going through the evidence again and discovers in one of the pockets a watch fob pocket that had been sewed in. And inside the watch fob pocket is a rolled up piece of paper upon which is written the words Tamam Shud.
Can you spell this? I'm taking notes now.
T-A-M-A-M. It might be Taman. Is it Taman or Tamam? Let's find out. Tamam Shud. No, it's Tamam Shud with an M.
Tamam Shud Tell me what this means.
And the A has a little accent aigu on it.
Wait, what? There's diacritics on the secret message?
Yes. Taman should with Tamam the diacritic.
Taman should.
And it
sounds
is,
like Hebrew or something.
Well, it is taken from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
Really?
Which is a kind of epic poem.
Famous Arabic poem.
And it means, it is finished.
This is the kind of thing that only happens in suspense novels.
Yes.
This does not happen in real life.
Well, as you can imagine, all of Australia is on pins and needles at this point.
Oh, I'm going to get yelled at for saying Khayyam was Arabic when he was Persian.
Persian.
The Iranians do not like that.
No, they don't.
Please do not fatwa me for misattributing the Rubaiyat.
So the detective then says, here is a page taken from the Rubaiyat. Does anyone have a copy of this book where
the
page has been ripped out or this has been excised by...
So it's not just somebody has written this, like, no. It's been cut out of a printed version of the Rubaiyat.
That's right. It's from a book.
Is it from the Fitzgerald translation, or does the fact that it says Tamam should mean it's actually in...
No, it's the translation. Oh, okay. It's the Fitzgerald translation. Astonishingly, someone does come forward and says they found this book in the back seat of their car, possibly the week before the murder.
What?
Or maybe within a day of the murder.
Somebody in Adelaide mysteriously finds a new book of poetry in their car?
And has been tossed in the back window, because December 1st in Australia is the middle of the summer.
You've cracked this mystery, John. This is like this would be how an Encyclopedia Brown would end. They couldn't have been on the beach in July because in Australia, that's the winter.
That's right. Middle of the summer. He's on the beach, you know, wearing a jacket and a sweater. But whoever it was that found the book in the back of their car, the windows had been rolled down and somebody had tossed the book in the back seat. And of course, if you find a copy of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam in the back of your car, you're going to note it.
But that seems like an improbable way for a murderer to dispose of a pretty important clue, right? Like,
I don't know.
If you cut the phrase you left on your body out of a book you own, yes, you could toss it in somebody's car to cover your tracks, but wouldn't you just be more likely to throw it in the garbage or burn it?
Well.
Or toss it in the Indian Ocean? Or
wait.
Okay.
Because when the police retrieve the book, they find, yes, it is the copy from which this It Is Finished has been
it matches
cut. But there's a page which has impressions of a secret message. And when they shade over the impressions.
Like Big Lebowski style?
Big Lebowski style. Here is what... If you're taking notes, here's what how the message reads. WRGOABABD.
Okay.
And then MLIAOI, but that's crossed out. And then WTBIMPPANETP. And then the letter X. But that's crossed out.
You don't have to cross out the letter X. X is how you cross things out.
No, then it becomes...
it's like an asterisk.
Yeah, it's an asterisk at that point. Then
you can't cross out an X. You could just make it stairs.
There's more.
Oh, sorry.
MLIABOAIAQC. And then finally, ITTMTSAMSTGAB.
This is all too baroque to be real. My theory of the crime is now that the man killed himself after leaving behind purposely tantalizing and misleading clues.
Okay, that is potentially a theory. But also, in the back of this book is a telephone number.
Mm.
A telephone number traced to an Adelaide resident by the name of Jessica Ellen Thompson. This information is not revealed to the public. The police,
to protect the local Sheila.
That's right. The police go to Jessica Ellen Thompson and they say, do you know this Do you know why this man would be here with your... Do you know why your number would be in the back of the book that had the next to the code that where part of it was in the pocket of the man who died on the beach? She says, no, I have no idea. But they take her to the coroner's office where they show her the plaster cast. And according to everybody in the room, she gasps and turns away and won't look at it, but denies that she knows the man.
Come on. Come on, Jessica.
In the process of interviewing her, she reveals that she did own a copy of the Rubaiyat during the war and gave it as a gift to a romantic partner of some kind whose name was Alf Boxall.
This would not have been uncommon at the time. The Rubaiyat was famously a love poem, and you know, even though it has some erotic content, the fact that it had some classical appeal and respectability meant
you could give it to a lover,
to a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and it'd be like, teehee, yeah. we're going to be in a shady bower someday, you and I.
That's right. It just seemed, but it's also kind of somewhat famously a book where suicide features.
Oh, it's true.
And so it's also considered kind of a, if you're going to romantically commit suicide, this would be somewhat of a template. But you're right. It's a romantic, epic Persian love poem. So the cops find Alf Boxall.
There is a real elf.
There is an elf.
It's Fair Dinkum.
It is Fair Dinkum. He still has the Rubaiyat given to him by Jessica Thompson. But when the police acquire that copy, they find that the last page of the book is intact.
Well, we already know it couldn't be the book that the phrase was cut from, right?
Oh, right, of course, because that book is in the custody of the police. But they do find that he... This isn't the book because he has the book.
Okay.
Unless he went to the bookstore and bought a new copy, but presumably this one has been endorsed to him by
Jessica. So little here is Fair Dinkum. It's not even any kind of dinkum.
Now, as dedicated Australian listeners will at this point kind of confirm, they're all nodding their corn cob pipes or whatever it is that they do there to assent to the veracity of a story. At this point, it is there are all kinds of swirling suspicions. Is the victim a Soviet spy? Was Boxall a spy? Is this is right after the war? Could this be a war criminal from the Nazis who has showed up and is now finally been tracked down by Mossad?
I mean, this is the kind of thing you would think in 1948 anyway, is like, how does this relate to the Cold War?
That's right. He's buried in a, you know, not exactly a pauper's grave, but in a, you know, a publicly funded grave.
Hard to put a name on the stone.
Weirdly, after a few years, flowers start appearing on the grave. So the police stake out the grave, and a woman is caught putting flowers on the grave. They question her. She denies knowing the man and has no convincing alibi for putting flowers on the grave.
Who was the Sheila bringing these prezzies?
That's right. Who was the Sheila indeed? Now, this becomes a sort of D.B. Cooper-level enduring mystery in Australia through the whole sort of mid-century.
And didn't you love these growing up? Where's Judge Crater?
I did.
You know? Who was D.B. Cooper? So generations have played this game.
That's right.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today. Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
But in 2009...
Oh, no breaks in the case for 60 years.
I mean, little tantalizing. I mean, you, as you saw in 59, the people had that story about the the people carrying him along. It remained. I mean, people were constantly coming forward. At the time, I think 40 different people claimed to have a suggestion about who it might be. They thought it resembled this guy, except that guy didn't have a mole.
Well, it raises the broader question of like how easy it is to just disappear, and if you're not reported as a murderer, to not be connected with a body. You know, like, because it's not just who is this? It's like, how did somebody else go away?
Right, right. Well, and that ends up a part of the story. Yes, right. How could someone...
Who's the unaccounted for person?
Yeah, die on a beach and nobody misses them.
Even if the fact that the face of the body was circulated around and still nobody is like, oh yeah, this guy.
And also, he doesn't appear to be a vagrant. He didn't wash up. He's not a sailor washed up on the shore. He's like a well-dressed,
he seems like somebody who would be connected with enough people to,
right,
to be recognized or have somebody report his disappearance.
Well, in 2009, this University of Adelaide professor by the name of Derek Abbott, because the thing is, there's also a cryptological component. What is that code? The code of what seem to be random letters, you know, code breakers say, well, it's not random. The frequency of the letters is...
There are patterns.
Is too... You know, it can't be random, but at the same time, there aren't enough letters to really decode it if it's an alphabet. It's suggested that what they seem like is the first, each one is the first letter of a different word. So what these are is sentences.
That is what it looks like.
You know, that are just kind of abbreviated by first letter only. At some point, someone says, the last set of lyrics, ITT, or the last set of letters, ITTMTSAMSTGAB.
I think that my trousers smell, and maybe, I don't know, what is it?
It's time to move to South Australia to Mosley Street. Mosley Street.
What?
Being the street where Jessica Ellen Thompson lives.
But there's nothing to connect it to any, it could be any Adelaide street that begins with M.
That's right.
But his theory is...
Mosley Street. I mean, this is, you know, this is codebreakers sitting and toying with these letters for years. This is what they come up with.
It just seems like
it's time to move to South Australia.
I don't think there's enough there.
No, that's not even what you would say if you were writing a coded note to yourself.
Now, just don't forget...
It's like a murderer.
It's not even like move to South Australia. It's like it's time to move.
It's time to move to South Australia.
It sounds more like a tourism slogan.
Yeah, it's not. It doesn't seem likely. But this is the this is the level of code breaking that's going on. And I think
brutal.
what Derek Abbott does at first is he tries cracking the code. That's how he gets involved. But as he gets more and more engaged in trying to solve the question of the Somerton man, he realizes a couple of things in looking at all the evidence. And one of them is that the man had unusual ears, unusually shaped ears.
And this has not been noted by anybody who saw the body or the death mask.
No, and perhaps it's because at the time there wasn't all the evidence of like, oh, well, these ears only appear in 2% of the population.
Well, it's Australia in 1948. Nobody even has a college degree.
Yeah, half the people don't even have ears. And then also he noted that the man has what's called hypodentia or hypodontia, which is
small
that
teeth?
Yeah, well, that his that there are teeth that didn't grow all the way in.
Mm.
And these are... you know, these put him in a category of people with very rare and genetic.
Oh, he can see genetic markers.
Distinctively.
He can start to use 23andMe type data to figure out who this guy might be.
That's exactly right.
He
suggests that they exhume the body to get DNA material. But the authorities say just because you have some theory about this guy doesn't warrant us exhuming the body. So
the court does not say good on ya.
No, the court does not. But so he, Abbott, seeks out the family of Jessica Ellen Thompson.
Why would they have the right to?
Because Jessica Ellen Thompson No, they wouldn't have the right to exhume them. Oh. But he's interviewing them because there's been, throughout the course of this mystery,
suspicion
thrown her way. That Jessica Thompson knew, that knew the man. And in the course of that, he discovered that Jessica's son, Robin, who was a somewhat famous ballet dancer, also had both the unusual ears and the hypodontia.
Does he survive? Can we produce Robin?
Robin has died.
When?
Weeks before. No, I don't know.
Sometime in the intervening years, Robin has died, but it's not. But it's clear he's not. Like, could the corpse be Robin?
No. Robin was born in 19.
Oh, Robin's born after.
Well, not after. Robin was 16 months old in 1948 when the body was discovered.
So it's Robin's dad.
So the mystery man is suspected to be Robin's father. Robin is the son of the mystery woman, Jessica Thompson. Jessica had married a man by the name of Prosper Thompson. That sounds like somebody that came over on the Mormon Trail.
That's a pioneer.
Prosper Thompson. But they didn't marry until 1950. But Prosper Thompson was separated from his wife the year before, and it was suggested that he and Jessica had been in a relationship
prior
to their marriage. And so Robin had always been assumed to be the son of Prosper Thompson, although Prosper was still married at the time. Robin's younger sister, Kate Thompson, actually went and did an interview with Australian television where she said that her mother inexplicably spoke fluent Russian and that she suspected that her mother and the missing man were spies. Or the dead man, not missing, the dead man. That they were both spies. Maybe Alf Boxall, her mother, and the dead man were all Soviet spies.
In an Adelaide spy ring.
In an Adelaide spy ring. Well, at this point, Derek Abbott is hooked. He thinks that the ballet dancing, the strange ears, and the crazy teeth pretty much conclusively prove that Robin is actually the son of the dead man, that Jessica, who is now dead, never owned up to.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of his investigations, he discovers that Robin had a daughter, Rachel, whom they gave up for adoption. Rachel was raised in New Zealand, but was discovered by David Abbott in the course of the investigation. He interviewed her, and within a day of interviewing her, they both decided that they loved each other and got married.
He married the suspect's granddaughter.
He married the suspect's granddaughter. They had three kids. In 2021, they finally succeeded in exhuming the body. But it was actually DNA, the conclusive DNA. And the thing is, I first read about this story a decade ago, and it was in the category of like unsolved mysteries full of crazy clues.
Yeah.
And how could this all stitch together? What kind of Soviet agent was the missing man? Who will decode the mystery? Why was the cigarette on the lapel? Why didn't he use the ticket?
What does the code mean?
Why didn't he vomit? Who gave him the digitalis?
Why didn't he vomit? Maybe he just has a strong stomach for bad Tucker, as we say.
Or maybe he did vomit somewhere else, and then his body was moved by a well-dressed man who carried him on his shoulder, and then...
But his arm moved at the
beach? His arm moved because a crab... pinched him, or it was somebody, the coroner suggested it might have been a death spasm.
Doesn't happen that much, right? Dead bodies just reaching out.
Rachel, who has publicly somewhat in tongue-in-cheek and pretty definitely not tongue-in-cheek, says that she thinks that Abbott married her just because he wanted some of the missing man's DNA in his children. In 2022, in collaboration with an American forensic genealogist named Colleen Fitzpatrick, they took a hair from the plaster cast.
Oh, there was hair stuck in
there. There was a hair in the cast. They did a DNA test and discovered, and using this kind of DNA reverse osmosis, they compiled a family tree of people in Australia that had some sort of DNA connection. They made a family tree of 4,000 people that all were related, distantly related to this DNA, and then went through all of the 4,000 people looking for someone who met the description of a man in his late 40s, early 50s, who was missing, and they narrowed it down and narrowed it to an electrical engineer.
Oh, screwdriver.
By the name of Carl Webb.
Carl Weathers.
And Carl Webb.
Carl Webb does sound like a spy name.
It does.
Carl Webb's totally in with the Soviets.
But Carl Webb seemingly was not a Soviet. He had left his wife in 1947, and she had moved down to South Adelaide, somewhere in the region, you know, within 50 miles of South Adelaide. And he had sort of disappeared in the 40s, late 40s.
So he can't be accounted for.
And nobody noticed he was gone.
So that's kind of sad.
In 1951, Dorothy...
He must not have had any good mates.
Well, that's it. In 1951, his wife, Dorothy, finally filed for divorce, accusing him of desertion, although he was at that point dead over 2 years.
If he's our guy. Are there photos of him?
That's right. There are no photos.
Come on, Carl.
Of Carl Webb. There is a photo of his brother that was taken when he was in a concentration camp in...
Japanese prison camp
somewhere. He died in the prison camp. But the photograph of him does resemble the plaster bust of our man.
And by this time, there's no living person who can attest to what Carl Webb even looked like.
None. But Dorothy's sister, Dorothy and her sister are both long dead, but Dorothy's sister at the time was married to a man named Thomas Keene.
Oh, there we go.
So Carl Webb...
Stole his brother-in-law's...
Stole his brother's tie and pajama bottoms, or whatever. And that was the final tie that connected him.
They are all descended from criminals. Just some random guy will just steal his brother-in-law's pajamas in Australia.
What confuses me is that Derek Abbott is still married to Rachel... The adopted out daughter of Robin the ballet dancer with the ears and teeth.
And that was a false lead, the whole thing?
They are not related in any way.
That's kind of to his credit that he didn't divorce his wife as soon as he discovered she was a red herring.
Well, this only happened last year.
Oh, they could still
so
be
I
on
wonder,
the rocks.
I wonder what the conversations are like around the dinner table there. Like,
presumably at this point they have more in common than the criminal coincidence that brought them together.
But they had on the wall of the... possibly still do, had a portrait painted of the Somerton man, which they had hanging in their home as what they assumed was their relative, their patriarch. And whether that painting is still there, I wonder which detective is going to investigate that.
It seems like none of this solves the mystery of how he died or if it's foul play, who might have killed him.
100% does not, and reinforces the idea.
Unless Thomas Keene was mad at the underpants thefts.
It reinforces the idea that he just committed suicide out of despair at not having any friends and living in stolen brother-in-law's shirt.
I mean, Tamam Shud does match the, it's more of a suicide note. It could be we're getting rid of the loose end in our criminal or spy conspiracy.
Yeah.
But it's more like a suicide note, right?
Seems like.
Because if you're trying to cover up a murder, you don't want to leave a little clue like, here's a poem.
But for a lonely electrical engineer, it's a pretty poetic last gesture, especially since it seems like if he had thrown the book in the back seat of the car, that he was, if not leaving a trail, then at least in the throes of despair enough that he was like, get this book from me. I mean, why wouldn't he just carry the book with him?
And what happened? He was married but walked out on her, right?
Yeah. And then maybe was down there looking for her, hoping to find her and reunite.
Oh, because they lived together elsewhere, but she had moved to Adelaide?
After he broke up with her in 47, the year before. And you could see that maybe he had a cigarette and he was ready to light it and then just set it down on his collar as the digitalis took effect, or it fell onto his jacket. You know, he took the digitalis and was ready to have one last cigarette.
I mean, sitting propped up at the beach looking at the ocean seems like it might be a lonely man's way to go.
But very, I mean, very much a poet at heart. I mean, if you can judge a man by the quality of his suicide.
Well, do you think there's possible that...
Why he wouldn't just clutch the book to his chest rather than do this whole...
Is it possible that leaving this kind of intricate, complicated body behind... I mean, maybe he gives no thought to what investigation will go into his death and...
Almost certainly didn't.
He naively assumes, oh, people will just be like, oh, Carl Webb died.
Yeah, Carl Webb died, poor sap.
But if it's
and that was a message to his wife.
Yeah, exactly. You should have been nicer,
well,
Doris.
Well, because we don't know if she had a relationship to that text. Probably so. That would have been a little...
Could have been, if that's
a little
their,
hat tip to her.
If that's a love poem between them.
But what he did was make himself a figure of fascination for the entire nation of Australia for...
Apparently unwittingly.
Yeah, for two lifetimes.
Unless it is like, this is what I'm thinking. This is the engineer's brain, like, let me leave behind a more compelling death, you know? Including leaving the clue behind in the car and leaving the secret words in the clue he leaves behind in the car. And I mean, I guess he likely did not arrange to have an odd collection of things in his pocket. Leaving a suitcase that left luggage is something that an unthinking suicide would do as well.
I suppose.
I don't know.
Well, I should say to our listeners, don't commit suicide. You are loved.
Content warning.
Also, do not, I mean, it is not better to commit suicide
in a fascinating and dramatic way,
even though it may seem that way to you right now in your despair. Keep listening to Omnibus, and
even the most troubled life is better than the most fascinating suicide body.
Exactly. We love you, and keep on keeping on,
especially if you're Australian.
Mm.
And that concludes Somerton Man. Entry 1189.PS7902, certificate number 35821, in the Omnibus. Futurelings, any codes or clues we would leave behind us to our identities and times would have been found on social media. If Carl Webb had had a Facebook page, we would know.
Yes. We would have known instantly, right? Or like, oh yeah, here's spatial recognition, blah, blah, blah.
It would, because you would go back in his feed and find like, you know, feel like she just want her back. Mm-hmm. She moved to Adelaide.
Here's a copy, or here's a quote from my favorite book, this dramatic book that makes me seem dramatic.
Does anybody know where to find orange thread for a ripped pocket? His Google searches include how to balance cigarette on lapel.
Well, now this is a question. Could someone go missing? I mean, yes, there are still plenty of unhoused people and sex workers that go missing, and they're hard to identify. But
could somebody with a family and a career and
could a middle-class electrical engineer die on a beach and have their picture published all across the land and people just like, meh, I don't
It does
know.
Make you wonder just... if this could have happened in the United States in 1948. Mm. You know, is Australia a little bit more Wild West in any way that means it was harder to find a missing engineer? You know, like, what did his employer think? We don't know. Because nobody thought to ask until 80 years later.
I mean, if you think about it, his wife waited like 3 years and was like, well, I guess he's not coming back. I'm filing for divorce.
But is that also what they thought down at the lab? Like, whatever happened to Carl?
What, but she never looked at the newspaper?
Her husband's face apparently was plastered all over in plaster form.
Oh, my God.
I didn't actually mean to do that.
Oh, my God. Where's my bell? You know, people yell at me all the time for not acknowledging your...
I didn't even mean to do that.
Your corny jokes, but that's, here you go.
I should have pretended that I meant to do that.
That was under seven newspapers, that bell. I was behind seven proxies.
Yeah, I just don't know if it could happen today. That's why the last good crime was 1948. And today they're all born.
Here, my friend.
The last good war followed by the last good dead body. Mm-hmm. At Omnibus Project jointly, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with your theories of the crime. You could, if you're that Robin guy, let us know. Do you disagree with this new theory of the crime? Are you going to put out your own book with your own convictions about Ballet Slipper Man? I don't understand how the dead man's dance-pointed toes were passed along to his child. Or is it just an interest in dance was passed along?
Well, maybe it was a genetic predisposition to big calves that would make you a natural dancer.
Do you believe there's a genetic predisposition to dance?
Maybe. Wonder. Yeah,
it's true that my family has no dancers in it.
Okay.
Which would, you know, that's the negative case.
Right. I mean, he might have had Charcot-Marie-Tooth syndrome, but it was not identified at the time, unknown to
people. I can't think of any second generation dancers. Who are the great Nepo baby dancers?
Well, I mean, a lot of the dancers didn't have children because they were so busy dancing.
I thought you were going to say because they're gay.
Well, that was what I was implying.
And I was going to say...
Morris didn't have any children.
They could still have kids.
That's true.
But today...
That's true.
Maybe less likely in the 19th century or early 20th.
Yeah. Did Baryshnikov have kids?
Baryshnikov? I guess a lot of those, I mean, maybe not so much in dance. Maybe dance was the one field where gay guys were not closeted and, you know, wife and two kids in the suburbs.
Right.
You could actually be an out gay dancer. That aside, because it has little to do with this outro, you could send us physical objects to P.O. Box 55744. Shoreline, Washington. I had one more. Didn't I have one more letter here somewhere? It's around for sure.
Get it.
Here we go. Nat. Oh, Nat Gertler. Whom I actually know. He was a contestant on a game show I was a panelist on. And I remember the name because he's kind of an expert on the comic strip Peanuts, I think.
What?
I think I'm thinking of the right guy. This has got to be him because he writes about 20th the century
Peanuts?
Cartoons.
Did he write us and say, hey, more about the Peanuts? It's the one thing I really know.
No, in addition to his Peanuts work, he wrote a book called Wife Gets Smart, Makes Husband Happy, Supermarket Comic Strip Ads of World War II. I would love to read actually a book of supermarket comic strip ads of World War II.
Me too.
And he wanted a little color for its back cover, so he scanned in this document. And then he said he realized it was the kind of thing we would like, but it was also the kind of thing he liked, and therefore, kind of selfishly, in my opinion, he decided to keep it. But then he thought he could buy a second one and send it to us. So he sent us a 25-cent defense stamp album.
Cool.
From World War II. This is cool. I've never heard of these.
Oh, very cool.
You could spend a quarter to buy a war stamp where you could, you know, you spend... Oh, so I guess the idea is you would spend a quarter, get a stamp, and then you could turn in the quarters for a single bond so that it's for people who didn't have the money up front.
Oh, I see.
To get a bond. It's essentially a punch card to buy war bonds with. The one he sends us... actually has four stamps already in it. So somebody got all the way to a dollar.
And then left it in a drawer.
And then never got to the $20 or the $18.75 level that he would need. 75 stamps would have let them go to the post office and exchange this for a Series E $25 savings bond. But this person, apparently either the war was won in time or this guy became a foreign agent and decided to stop.
Happens a lot.
What a mystery. What a 40s mystery we have here, John. You think it's too late?
I think all these 40s mysteries are starting to stack up on one another.
Staples slightly rusty. Some yellowing and foxing on back cover. That points out that we could time travel back to 1942, and if we could, it would only take us $17.75 to trade this in for a $25 savings bond.
I hate to break it to Nat, but we cannot time travel back to 1942. Yet, that technology has not been invented.
But once it does, we really have a leg up here. Because this is not just a dollar. This is, you know, whatever a dollar in 1940 whatever was. You know, this is $5 or something.
Yeah.
You don't seem that interested in these stamps.
Well, I want to see them. Hogging them as per usual. Oh, they're so cool.
America on guard, says each stamp.
On guard.
I kind of thought it was a ka-chunk stamp when I read Nat's description, but it turns out to be a pasted-in stamp.
They're really pretty, and you could see how this... Well, you know what? This book was meant to be filled with stamps and...
That's what I'm saying. It's kind of a sad story.
Yeah, it is a little bit. I mean, maybe their boy died in the war and...
Maybe they died. Maybe it was an elderly person started keeping that and then had a heart attack.
No, wait a minute. You're the guy that knows how much a 1944 dollar is worth today. How much is it? How much is a 1944 dollar worth today?
$17.
That's exactly what I thought it was going to be. I guess
you were going to guess
in my mind. I should have said it out loud because I would seem really smart.
I guess low before. I actually know the multiplier to get to 10. It's changed recently, obviously, because inflation's back. But the multiplier to get to 10 usually put you back in the baby boom sometime.
Yeah, right.
But wow. 18 modern Biden bucks in that $1 of stamps.
Biden bucks. All the murderers listening to our show are laughing right now at your Biden bucks.
We only have one murderer listening.
I feel like the fact that...
I'm kind of worried that we're encouraging more murderers...
To listen to the show?
No, more listeners to become murderers.
I don't think so.
No?
I think that the listeners are... The 49,999 of our listeners who are not murderers...
Yet.
Let's say... 49,995 of our listeners that can be confirmed not to be murderers, they probably are not murderers because they don't have it. They don't have the murderer in them. They don't want to be murderers already. You're suggesting that we have listeners that are frustrated non-murderers.
There would be murderers that have just not been placed in the right situation.
Yeah, they're like, God, I really want to murder, but...
That is a bleak view of humankind. That most people would do a murder given sufficient...
Well, I didn't think you were saying most of our 49,995 listeners wanted to be murderers. I was thinking it would be another 5 to 10.
Oh, no. I think it's much higher than that.
I think it's a lot more. Which percentage of you and me wants to be a murderer that...
I mean, given how many murders happen that are just kind of an odd situation, you know, a robbery goes wrong, an argument gets too heated... Mm-hmm, your wife is standing too near a cliff and you're thinking about your girlfriend. Mm-hmm. You know, just imagine how many of those bad marriages just have not had the right road trip to a national park yet.
And you think the two of them are right now on their way to the Grand Canyon listening to Omnibus in the car.
They're certainly looking at each other right now that you're saying this.
I see, eyeing each other like, which of us is the nascent murderer?
Which of us is the victim here? No, the husband. The husband's always, it's always the husband.
That is not true. In fact, I bet there are more female murderers listening to our show right now than male murderers.
Only one way to settle this. All murderers listening now need to write in with their pronouns.
Right.
So that we can figure out.
And a clue about a past murder.
Yeah, that no one else has.
What we want to do is prevent the next murder, but we don't want you to reveal your murderer status because you're not going to do it if we say, oh, give yourself up.
Not going to do what?
Send us the deets.
Oh, I see. We're providing amnesty for your past murders insofar as that can be promised by a podcast.
Here's what we want. Write us your manifesto. write us your manifesto about modern life and digital life, and we will absolutely not send it to your brother.
What happened to our conceit that we were speaking to far future organisms? Don't you think murder has been eliminated?
Absolutely not. Murder
is more
probably,
common than ever in the post-apocalyptic Earth.
What do you think octopus's relationship to murder is?
They get murdered by sharks. They're like the smart, enlightened teachers of the reef.
Yeah, but no, they're constantly murdering shellfish and whatnot.
That's probably true.
Yeah. If the future is full of shellfish, if it's like sentient shellfish, then maybe, you know, what are shellfish murdering?
I guess the question is, who gets enough sentience to listen to podcasts? The predator class or the prey class?
Almost certainly the predator class, right?
Well, I mean, we're humans and we're not apex. I mean, we're apex predators now, but like we didn't evolve that way.
Didn't we?
I think we were still getting, weren't we still getting eaten by tigers and bears until relatively recently?
Well, but only incidentally. We were never the primary prey of tigers and bears. We were always just getting swiped by them on their way to killing tastier food. Predators want things like elk that are full of haunches. Our haunches are bad tasting.
So you think the reason we survived is not just that we learned to use tools faster than elks?
Yeah.
It's because they looked more delicious?
Yeah. Were more delicious.
They do to me. I mean, if I go to a place that has an elk burger and it has a human burger, I'm totally getting the elk burger.
If you were a tiger who had tried elk and human both, you would go back to the other tigers and say, look, the one with the horns, tasty. The little one with the loincloth, blech.
But it's an interesting question. None of the real apex predators did evolve into
smarties,
into tool use.
Well, who eats apes? Nobody eats apes.
We were left alone.
Yeah, apes are apex predators in the sense. Even if I mean they're not.
They're apex predators of fruit.
No animal eats apes. I mean, I guess tigers sometimes or leopards or whatever jump on monkeys.
That's why we evolved, because we were just sitting off doing our own thing, letting the mean animals eat the delicious animals.
Yeah.
And we were just like the snarky theater kids of the jungle. That guy got eaten again.
Mark.
With a separate cafeteria table that's out of the food chain.
Yeah. And then we learned to run fast, and then we got spears.
Somebody needs to tell us if this is good science or bad science.
I think it's great science. I mean, you know, Einstein loved to talk about evolution, his famous theory of evolution.
Yeah. Remember when Einstein looked back at the lake and said apes were at the wrong cafeteria table?
E pluribus unum is what he said. I'm just reflecting the science.
I can't remember what I was saying before this outro started stretching out.
About.
It was about an hour and a half.
You know what it is? You hate it when your episodes are longer than mine. So this one, you just decided to ramble.
I feel like this outro is your rambling.
You were rambling way before I was. I was busy looking at my phone.
Write in and tell us which of us made this show interminable. You can send that to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. Thank you for the war bonds, Nat. Nice to hear from you again. The most important way to support the show is not to send us a dollar's worth of World War II stamps.
$17, but sure.
Well, there was only a dollar worth of stamps. Oh, right. 17 Biden bucks. Thanks, Joe Brandon. I guess that's not as funny in April, like when the election's a lot closer. No more Biden jokes.
Well, no, it's months before the election. We can still make but I mean, we do encourage you to vote.
And not for Biden's opponent. What if he's not alive when this airs?
Who, Biden or Biden's opponent?
Either of them. They're both 108.
I mean, if neither of them are alive, there's no precedent for that both candidates for president die within a year of the election. That would be a mad scramble.
Well, I think it's easier if they've picked a vice presidential candidate. If it happens sometime in the if it happens sometime in the primary process, then it's a weird party level scramble for sure.
Well, but I don't think a vice presidential candidate would automatically step forward. I mean, they certainly would try, but I don't think the parties would be like automatic president.
I think it looks weird if they don't.
Oh yeah, maybe.
Right?
Maybe.
Like, we skipped you.
But I mean, a lot can change in 6 months.
Yeah? I mean, are you pondering a murder? Is that what you're saying?
No, but I hope I change a lot in the next 6 months.
I think of our...
Learn and grow.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Whichever of our listeners is a murderer, I would like to think is maybe an assassin.
Listeners are murderers. Like, oh, you think they might be like cool assassins?
Yeah, not they're not just like weirdo spree killers. And also they're not just like, I snapped at my significant other.
Right. You think that they're out there. They're listening to this podcast right now, looking through a scope...
Yes.
Somewhere in a suburb of Paris.
It calms them. In the same way that some of our listeners go to sleep by listening to the show, others find that their trigger finger is just smoother when they're listening to this this show.
Yeah, they're watching some sort of Egyptian industrialist who's having an affair in a penthouse apartment in Paris.
Oh, sorry. The woman just walked in front of the scope. Don't fire. Now who's making this entry longer? John.
Huh? What? Who?
The thing to do to support the show is to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject because there... And do it now. Do it now while you're thinking about it because...
Because we won't end the show until you do.
It's like a pledge drive. We won't go back to Masterpiece Theater until we hit our limit for the hour and we are still six donors short.
That's
we need six more calls at this hour.
We're going to get Joey Lawrence out here. Hey, Joey, come on and do a song.
This turned from a PBS pledge drive to some kind of a telethon.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That's right.
We're going to have
Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin reunite on stage after years of estrangement.
Of our listeners, the ones who are murderers, do you think they're Patreon level? What Patreon level do you think our murderer is? Non-donor?
Murderers. I think that they are absolutely at the $10 level.
Oh, do you think that's the most sus level we have, is the $10 tier?
I think that's where the murderers probably go. I'm not saying everybody there is a murderer, but the number of the murderers who recognize references to the Jerry Lewis telethon are going to be for sure at the $10 level.
Because they trend older and are therefore more generous to nonprofits?
No, because they are the smarter of the murderers, and they recognize cultural references maybe that even predate them. They're probably millennials, smarter millennials.
Judging by their calf muscles, they may do tap or jazz dance.
Mm-hmm. The 10% of millennials that became hired killers.
Listen, whether you're a murderer or a future victim of our murderer, do you think our murderer murders fellow listeners to our show? Yes, right?
Écoutez, amidi. No, I do not think. I think that our murderers
they hunt elsewhere.
Yeah.
If you're ever at a rest stop or a gas station or a rest stop and somebody asks, do you listen to Omnibus from the darkness? Say yes.
Say yes.
It will protect you.
Yes, that's right. It's like putting a little dab of blood on the door of your house. It will save you. Wear your Futurelings t-shirts everywhere you go. As a talisman against disaster.
So we want to thank our murderers at the $10 level. But there's a lot of value right now at the $5 level, John. We've just added, in addition to the monthly addenda show you would hear.
If you call now.
If you act now, we will throw in an early version, an early ad-free version of every weekly omnibus entry on Tuesday.
That's so sassy.
48 hours in advance of the mass of humanity, you, the Ubermensch, the Nietzschean, Dostoevskian spree killer, will be able to listen to Omnibus ahead of the mewling masses.
Mm-hmm.
So before just taking an axe to some old lady, know that you have heard Omnibus ahead of her, and maybe that will forestall your crime.
That is so Raven.
Is it?
Yeah, is what I'm about to say here. That is so Raven.
Have you ever in the past compared things to Raven?
Yeah.
Is this the first time?
There are a lot of things that are so Raven.
There's a few things that are slightly Raven.
It's really Glow. You know what I mean?
The TV show Glow? Is Glow an adjective you're trying to get to catch on?
Yeah, fam. It means like this new thing is really glowing us up. This new ad-free thing is super...
Like something that got a glow up is adjectivally glow.
Yeah.
I'm learning now.
That's right. It's really dank.
You're looking for a list of AI provided list of slang and it's letting you down. See, this is a real argument against AI.
I'm just coming up with it. This is not like
AI is not helping you sound like a teen in real time.
This isn't big yikes. This is,
I think it's actually good that AI is not yet good enough to let a 50 something man sound like a teen. because there's no good use case for that technology.
Hey, this is no cap, bro. I'm saying this is high key, you know?
You're running through this list in alphabetical order.
It's not chuggy. It's not chuggy. It's not simp.
The fact that I can remember when all these actually were slang means you are not on the right list.
This is snack, brah.
You doing this is chuggy. It's cringe, and you're chuggy for doing this. So please go to patreon.com/omnibusproject to support the show. We promise to make it worth your while, and the $10 weirdos won't kill you.
That's right. As far as we know.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of up to them. I don't want to make any promises.
I mean, honestly, it's the Dax Shepard fans you have to watch out for. Because they're the ones that are going to murder you accidentally. They're gonna hit you with their car while they're looking at their phone.
They're going to kill you accidentally.
Yeah, they're going to bite into a Hot Pocket, and it's going to burn their lips, and they're going to, you know, I don't know, throw a knife at you.
They all work in fast food, and they're going to insufficiently cook your burger.
Yeah.
And you're going to die of E. coli.
They are
from some Dax Shepard listening prole.
They're driving entry level Audis, and they're just like, yeah, they're accidental murderers, but they're the type of people that would drive away from the scene of the crime.
It's true. You know what? I regret casting them as service industry workers. They're mm-hmm. not.
No.
You're right. They're middle managers.
Bouge.
They're middle managers.
They're bouge, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why are they killing people again?
Because they're dumb. They're the dumb Kevins of the podcast listening murderers, unlike omnibus listeners who are clever assassins and not spree killers, not impulse killers.
They're killing you by putting something in your groundwater to save a few bucks at work.
Or giving you a little digitalis as they cut all the labels out of your jackets.
Well, that's a different kind of killer.
Well, we're not sure. That mystery is unsolved.
They do it all.
Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. Providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese and hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.